Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I am your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 141 with Ivan Barrett on going from house hacking a duplex to owning more than $300 million in commercial real estate. Ivan was introduced through a mutual friend, and we circled schedules for months before finally getting this episode recorded. And this is an exciting one as we discuss Ivan's growth from digging out from several hundred thousand dollars in debt to now owning more than 3,000 multifamily apartment units. Any further description here by me will be a disservice to Ivan's experience, so we might as well just let him tell it. All right, Ivan Barrett, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Dan. Thanks for having me. I saw this on my calendar maybe a week or so ago, and I've been looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
For sure. Yeah, a mutual friend introduced us, kind of said, hey, you got to get this guy on the show. You got to talk to him. And it's been a challenge for both of us to get our schedules to line up. So here we are, and I'm sure the listeners and the audience is going to enjoy our conversation today. So, Ivan, for anyone who doesn't know who you are already, would you mind kind of giving a background, maybe how you got in real estate, what your business looks like today?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Ivan Barrett. Today I manage about $300 million in assets. We've got a company now, 80 employees strong. We just hit Inc. 5000 for the second time in a row. Hit one of the fastest growing companies down here in Indianapolis, where we're headquartered this year, having a lot of fun, own a lot of apartments these days and continue to manage for other investors as well. And believe it or not, that all started with a duplex that I house hacked after college. Getting started in real estate for me was pretty early. I had a dad, attorney, but always had real estate income property on the side. So I got to be his landscaping arm along with my brother at a very early age and thought, why would you want to get a real job? You know, why wouldn't you just own a lot of income property and watch the rent checks flow in every month? Well, it turns out it is a real job, but I do enjoy it. And wouldn't trade in what I do for anything.
Cool. So, I mean, you started out, what year was it that you got the duplex, if you don't mind sharing?
Not at all. So I got out of college in late 2000. And, you know, I'd read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. My dad says, hey, if you want to buy a house, you're on your own. But if you buy a duplex and live in one side and rent out the other, I'll match you on the down payment. So I thought, okay, fine, I'll do that. Because at the time, I didn't want to. You know, I'd just gotten out of Indiana University. I had this shiny business degree. I thought I was a hot shot. And I only wanted to do big development deals, right? I didn't want to mess around with little deals. And so I bought that rental property, made a ton of mistakes on it, lived in one side. And for the first part of my career, I actually worked in development. Learned a lot, but continued that hot shot attitude and thought I was the best thing since sliced bread and real estate was easy. And as you know, 2006, the cracks start forming. And by 2008, you know, everything had fallen off a cliff. And I had to come to the realization that I'd been practicing real estate in exactly the opposite manner that attracted it to me in the first place. I'd forgotten everything I'd learned about cash flow and income and risk management, and was just, you know, betting on the next big hit that I could develop and sell.
Interesting. All right, so let's talk about what the business is today, right? You and I took a look at your website before we hopped on the call, and the numbers you shared with me before the call were even bigger than the numbers on the website. So, you know, what led you to get into what you're doing now? And could you just kind of elaborate on the business model, maybe your investment philosophy, and perhaps like the types of deals that Barrett Asset Management is looking to buy now, how you make them profitable, if you do anything, any exit strategies, if any?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So in 2010, I founded the company in my spare bedroom by myself, and I started as a property management company for about the first 4 years. I was able to get a few of my own smaller deals. I started buying and rehabbing and leasing some banged up properties that sellers wanted to get rid of back in 2010 and emerging neighborhoods here in Indy. At the same time, I was managing anything I could get my hands on where I didn't have to carry a gun, and just started small and kept scaling up the management company first. And by 2014, I had a couple small apartment deals, a 30 unit deal, a 35 unit deal, a 15 unit deal. Then I syndicated a 60 unit project. And that's one that I just recently exited. We made about 17-18% internal rate of return over the 5 years that we've held it. That's actually on one of the lower ends of the returns we typically are getting on our deals right now. But today, we're only buying what we call site-managed apartment communities, where you've got a manager, leasing staff, maintenance staff on site, typically working out of a clubhouse with a pool and a fitness center. So we're buying B-plus, A-minus assets, 20 to 40 million here in the Midwest, we would call the nicer end of workforce housing. We're not buying luxury. And we're looking for a value add strategy. It's more focused on adding value on the management side, a little bit of physical improvements to the amenities, the unit, cosmetics, but mostly just buying a really good asset that we can squeeze a little more juice out of. And then we're really keen on the submarket that we're buying in, where we've got a high degree of confidence that our management team can raise rents. And those are all syndicated deals. Now we're in a multi-asset private placement, has some characteristics of a fund, so that our investors who want to get monthly cash flow can do so and have more diversification by not being in a single asset risk situation, but spreading those chips over a few assets as we continue to identify quality deals, which is really the hard part of my model right now, is finding the deals as we move into late 2019.
Yeah, it makes sense. You're in a competition with institutional size if you're at 20 and 40 and $30 million acquisitions. Can you, for listeners who may not understand syndication, would you mind defining, briefly what it looked like when you syndicated the 60-unit project versus the modification that you've undertaken over the past couple of years to get you to a place where you're doing multi-asset syndication?
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. It's my pleasure. So basically, I went out and found a property. Purchase price was a low $2 million range and needed approximately, say, $700,000 of equity to close the deal, have some cash for improvements, some reserves on hand. And so what I was able to do is put some of my own money to work, but then go out and via a private placement memorandum or a PPM, I was able to put my opportunity in front of existing relationships at that time that I already had a pre-existing relationship with that might be interested in investing along with me, offer them a preferential return, meaning they get some predetermined amount of return first, and then we split everything above that. So most syndications are some variation on that, where you put in 100 grand, you get the first amount of cash that comes out, you get up to an 8% annualized return. And then me as the sponsor or GP or promoter, which are all different words for the same thing, we split the remaining cash flow. In that case, it was 60-40. It might be all the way down to 90-10, 90 to the investor, 10 to me. There's all different kinds of deals out there. But basically, a syndication is where you're raising capital from others to come alongside yours and acquire the asset, and it becomes a security offering versus a real estate offering, even though the security is tied to real estate. And just so your audience knows, that doesn't mean it's a stock. It just means it falls under Securities and Exchange Commission guidelines. You have to know what you're doing. You have to be mindful of the rules on how you raise capital. Versus today, I can go out and I can put my advertising of a deal on a bus stop. I couldn't do that on that 60 unit deal, but now I can generally solicit, I can advertise. However, I can't any longer go to my friends and family and say, hey, you know what I'm doing, you've got some money, come along for the ride. Those people can still invest, but only if they're an accredited investor and their advisor, their attorney, their CPA, or mine actually signs a letter on their behalf stating that they meet the qualifications of an accredited investor, which, as you know, Dan, is $300,000 of W-2 income if you're filing jointly, or you can do it on what's called a net worth calculation, a million of net worth minus your personal home equity. You can't count your home residence towards your accredited investor status.
Nice. Yeah, I remember. I wanted you to define that. I remember when I first got into business myself back in 2006, and one of my mentors said something about, yeah, we did a land syndication deal. And I really didn't know what he was talking about, but then I remembered myself like cocktail party holding court kind of thing later, repeating the same verbiage. Yeah, I'm going to do a land syndication deal. And like people were nodding their heads, you know, like it's kind of foolishness. You know, I was 26 years old, different now. So I appreciate you shedding light on that part.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, if somebody downloads my stuff today, it's pretty sophisticated. We've been doing it a long time. We know what we're doing. It looks really sharp. But anybody looking to get into this business, I would say it's more about the opportunity and the relationships and that you have inside your own network to get started. There's a lot of people out there saying, oh, you can raise capital online. It's easy now. And you just go out and hit the easy button. Not true. In the beginning, I had a very simple offering memorandum. It was more based on people that knew me, relationships that I had built, the business plan that I had written, and gaining the trust of those investors to come along with me.
Yeah, that's a great difference, evolution, if you will. One thing I'm going to point out, we get a lot of single family investors here on the show who are flipping houses, want to, and a lot of people share the dream of going to the place that you're speaking from right now, Ivan. I want to do big multifamily commercial deals, the dollars are bigger, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to liken my example here and then tie it into something that you mentioned earlier. You talked about more value on the management side of the business, and I think it's pretty cool and critical, and I'm going to ask you in a moment to elaborate on that. But first, I noticed in my own examples, we did 125 closings. So we bought and then resold 125 houses so far year to date at an average
profit. That's a slow year for you, right?
Yeah, I guess it is. It's been up and down, and it's funny to see things leveling off, but it's been hectic and busy. Now, out of that volume of houses that we're flipping, one thing that is critical and an observation that I see, and then I'm sure the fix and flip investors either are figuring out now, depending on their experience, or already have figured out, but the way you manage the details of your contractors, that interaction, making sure things are done at the right schedule, making things sure that things are done right, managing every dollar in the construction project, I would imagine from my own limited experience in managing my own property managers that there's a lot of things you learn and ways to write contracts and little details that once these things add up, you get a compounding effect similar to what Warren Buffett would always talk about, where the results build upon each other and other and other. So I'm assuming I'm along the same lines with those examples, but would you mind talking a little bit to the topic of how you guys are adding some value on the management side of these larger projects?
Yeah, absolutely. And what you just said is so meaningful because a lot of people, I think, in our business, whether they're focused on, you know, a big deal or a small deal, they might think that this is, you know, something that happens all at once, or I'm going to get it all done in a weekend, or it's these, you know, these punctuated moments in time, right, where I'm going to put out this big effort. And really what it is, it's doing these little things better every day. These little habits, right? These little 1% improvement here, a 2% improvement there, that really add up and in the aggregate create a lot of value. For us, because we're vertically integrated and our management company isn't really designed as a profit center, it's more designed, how do we have the best machine possible to execute on these deals and make it all work? What that allows us to do is it allows us to have everything done in-house and keep our margins lower from a construction standpoint. What we're typically looking for is changes in the market that people haven't caught up with. So my two, I would say, most likely sellers are mom and pop companies, old school technology, old school way of doing things. And then on the other side of the spectrum, some of these bigger bloated companies that have been around a while. So we're able to utilize new technology. There's a lot more ways to extract more fees out of the property than some of these older companies. And so we've got some secret sauce there. But if you know what you're doing and you really know what it costs to run these things with your own team, because you built the right experience, then one out of every 100 to 200 deals, you're going to find one that somebody's running it for they're running it at too high of an expense. So for example, we just bought a small deal for us now, which was $18.5 million, 158 units in Evansville, Indiana, a great little submarket in Southern Indiana, 300,000 people. It's very close to Fort Wayne, up by you guys, in size, diverse economy. We bought a deal down there from an out-of-state ownership group who had hired a third-party property management firm to run it. And we were able to cut darn near $1,000 a door out of the annual budget in expenses.
Wow.
And that's the kind of value add that really helps us get a deal off the ground and return or hit those target returns that we look for our investors. Because right now, you know, everybody's looking for the hairy deal where they can put $15,000 a door in, raise rents $250 a door. The problem is you got so many buyers in that value add on the physical side. The you know what everybody's looking for, that they're overpaying it for it, which reduces the return, right? It's like you know, people paying too much for that next flip. When you're ready to sell, your margin gets hammered, right?
Yep.
Same thing.
Yep.
Same thing on the big deals. And what's great is when you do it right, there's a lot more zeros behind it, right? What's a little scary is if you don't do it right, if you do it wrong, there's a lot more zeros and there's a negative sign as well.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, just to tie it down to value, right? $1,000 in expense is equal to how much in value? Are we talking about like $10,000 in value for each of those doors? And it was what, 100 and how many units?
158 units.
So we got 158. And what would you say conservatively would be the value bump to give a perspective for what $1,000 in expense savings means for the deal?
Yeah, you know, $1,000 of expenses is going to be about $16,000 of asset value.
Which gives us like what?
It's like $2.6 million. So if you, you know, if I were to turn around and just sell that deal, I could flip it for gross profit of 2.6. Then you got transaction costs and everything else in there. But that's a deal that doesn't come along every day. It took us a year to get that deal. It was off market. You know, this deal never hit the open market. But on the conservative side, you know, we walked away with $1.5 million, and probably closer to $2.5 million of equity the day we bought it.
Nice. Not even including the value bump, right?
No, I'm specifically talking about the value bump here from getting the expenses to where they should be.
Gotcha. Okay, great. This is a nice segue into this. You mentioned the submarket, but didn't actually speak about this. Are you one of the guys flying all over the country looking at assets, or do you prefer them in a certain radius? I mean, what is it that characterizes a deal for Barrett Asset Management?
Yeah, so we're managing all our own assets. So we're continuing to hub and spoke from Indy in a disciplined manner. So I'm not flying to Texas tomorrow. We're looking more in markets that we can get to within a couple hours, whether that's by car or by direct flight.
Which I'd imagine there aren't quite as many out of Indy as there are Chicago or a larger city, the direct flights.
You'd be surprised. Indianapolis is coming along, but no, sure, Chicago's still got us beat. We like markets like Indianapolis when we can find a deal, but we're also more likely to find a deal in a tertiary market, 100 to 300,000 people. And so we focus in on those markets that have a really strong population growth that's consistent for the last decade, diversified employment. So, for instance, we bought a deal in Champaign, Illinois. You know, sometimes it gets thrown in the Illinois negative publicity right now, which made it a value for us, right? Champaign, Illinois is a great market. It's, what is it? A few hundred thousand people, maybe 280. Big, and people always get this assumed incorrectly. I'm still buying workforce housing. I'm not buying student housing, but I like the college university town. Small city, because those universities generate a lot of employment, got a big hospital network there, a lot of ancillary business that comes off of that university. And so that's the kind of smaller city we like. You got the university, you got government, you got healthcare. It's not a one factory town that's susceptible to like one major employer blowing out.
Smart. So what's the long-term strategy here? I mean, are you exiting, doing refinances, 1031? You know, for the new multi-asset syndication fund, a lockup period of how long, and what's your plan throughout that period, would you say?
Yeah. So we're like most real estate investors in that we're prepared to hold it long-term on these big deals. We get amazing financing that allows us to hold it longer if we need to, if and when that next bad market hits. But our target exit is somewhere between years 5 and 7. Because as you know, we want to continue to recycle and redeploy that capital to make sure we're getting a high return on equity as time goes on, not just a cash on cash metric. So we've already sold a couple deals. I'm in the middle of 3 refis right now that on deals that will hold probably closer to that 7 to 10 year time frame. But gosh, one of my earlier apartment deals, 90 units, sold that 2.5 years later because I got an offer I just couldn't refuse. And so, you know, took the chips off the table. The fun part now, thanks to namely the new Trump tax plan, the Jobs Act, the accelerated depreciation via cost segregation generates these giant losses. A few deals we sold in 18, because my investors and I bought other assets that generated new losses, they canceled out the taxable the tax bill on the sales without doing a 1031. And so this is just starting to get more awareness in the real estate investor community. So, for example, that deal I bought in Champaign, Illinois, bought it in December of 2018. For every $100,000 invested in that deal, which is paying 7% current return with a target return of 15% annualized, the investor received an $83,000 loss in 2018. They're getting cash flow and huge losses in year one. If we time that right, if one guy comes to mind perfectly, he sold two duplexes in Indianapolis, walked away with a big chunk of cash and also a big tax bill. But because he reinvested those proceeds into our deal in Illinois, his tax bill went from, like, I think $58,000 to zero.
Huh. Gotta love it.
Yeah. And we didn't have to do a 1031. We didn't have the time constraint, the extra fees, the tenant in common restrictions, all that other junk.
So, Ivan, here's one that's kind of out of left field a little bit. It's like
Throw it out there.
Maybe it's an unreasonable fear. Maybe it's just conjecture. But what do you think would be the long-term risk of apartment building investments? You guys have all been – everybody who's been on the show, everybody whose podcast I listen to, my friends who are doing the business like you, just keeps on saying it's getting harder and harder to find – the real estate deals. I mean, is there a chance that, I don't know if you're familiar at all with, like, Warren Buffett, the cigar butt theory of investing. Does that ring a bell at all for you?
I love Warren, but tell me what the cigar butt theory is.
So back in, I forget what years, and if someone knows the details, I apologize that I'm about to butcher the facts, but whenever it was.
Don't let the truth get in the way of a good cliche.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we're going to do. Great. Benjamin Graham was his teacher, and they would have this strategy of finding stocks. I think it was in the 40s or 50s. And he would have they would find the stocks that had plenty of assets left, but the businesses were basically crap. And so these stocks were trading at, right around the book value or even less. So for $20 per share, they would have $40 worth of assets. And sometimes he would go in. Warren Buffett went into one of these annual meetings and he showed up and he's, I want you guys to get, you're holding all this cash. I'm a shareholder. I want you to make a one-time special distribution, you know, amounting to $23 per share, whatever it was. And he ends up getting like his entire purchase price back in a form of a special dividend, hijacking the cash out of the company and then still owning the stock and still owning the company after that fact. So basically getting a refund after 100% plus return. And some of this occurred from my observation, Ivan, because the stock market was a slower, limited market than it is after the 1990s when things became digital and the data and ability to analyze stocks had gone up. These actually disappeared, these type of cigar butt opportunities to the caliber that Warren Buffett made many parts of his initial fortune, actually disappeared in the 60s and 70s. People caught on, saw the value, and then scooped the value out. You'd be hard-pressed to find anything out there in the marketplace like that today. And it's like, I wonder how much risk we have as real estate investors who are buying and selling properties when we have things like cost segregated depreciation kind of fueling some of the fury in the marketplace for people to do like a 1031. I would buy a deal, me, to avoid a tax consequence. If I'm stuck in the middle of a 1031 exchange, I would buy a deal. I'd have to compromise a little bit versus if I was going to go raise money on a deal and didn't have the motivation of closing out a 1031 to do the deal. So there's this like motivating force in the market to continue transactions happening. But then take something like crowdfunding and all the things that opened up the ability to raise money at online, digitally, digitizing these assets and creating more and more of these funds. Over time, do you think that it becomes less and less opportunity where maybe the people who are the best and hang on to these properties for like almost an indefinite period of time scoop up more of the assets where there's a day where it's just too dry for many people to succeed? Or is that like totally a risk that's just outlandish on my behalf?
Well, I thought you were going somewhere else with that, because I think there is a lot of risk building up in the system. And I, you know, one of my favorite books of this year so far is Howard Marks' book, another Warren Buffett value investor type guy, called Mastering the Market Cycle. What Howard said is at this stage of a cycle, right, where there's lots of optimism, there's lots of things trading, it's hard to find deals, be really freaking careful. And so that's what we're doing right now, is being really freaking careful and disciplined. And this is why I built a management company after I saw the last big crash, is because now I'm set up to where I don't have to do a deal to make payroll, because we have the management fees. So whether we do, zero or four deals this year, BAM stays solvent and keeps going. Because there's a lot of risk building up in the system. And so I don't think it just keeps getting more digital and less fragmented of a market. There's a few other factors that will keep property trading hands. The big one is that return on equity calculation, because let's say it's year seven, right? And I can put a few million bucks into my deal and do my own value add strategy, or I can sell it and return 20% to my investors on an annualized basis, right? Do about 3x their money, 3.5x in 7 years. So I either call up all my investors and say, hey, capital call, everybody put in more money and we're going to do this to the asset. Or I can sell it on the open market, take my returns and go show my track record and go do it again on another deal. Or maybe I sell it to myself in the fund. But there's a lot of forces that keep these properties turning on a 5, 7 to 10 year basis, commercial assets. What I think is a bigger risk right now is that you've got a lot of people in the market that are new to this game, that are desperate to find deals, that have not seen a down market. They think real estate is recession proof, multifamily is recession proof, which it can be. If you do it right, when this thing turns over, I won't be doing four deals a year, I'll be doing eight, because there'll be more opportunities in the marketplace that I'll have a chance at, and it'll shake out some of the new guys. So like right now, it's almost impossible for me to get an on market deal done at a price that makes sense. We draw our line in the sand, and there's greater fools out there that are willing to take a lower return, or they've got a more I'll say optimistic pro forma than I do. Which gives them the confidence to pay more for the asset. I think we're getting a little off maybe where you wanted me to go with that. So I'll let you pull me back in here and get me back on track if I've gone too far.
No, I love it. I think I went off too far in one direction too. And as I hear you talking about, why that risk is a little bit off base that I had when I mentioned it to you, I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's right. Like I see in my single family thing, I see people who have bought properties too much. And just like we talked about managing the details and having these like rituals and these habits and everything that are compounding and leading to more and more build up of momentum and success in business. And I know that happens in other places in life also. Those investors who are paying too much and more optimistic and have not lived through a recession and all the other things that maybe they're sloppy, maybe they're lazy, maybe they're undercapitalized. But yeah, those ships run aground when the tide goes out and it's too shallow to survive. So I really appreciate you pulling me back to reality. And I did read Howard Marks' book. Great suggestion there for anybody who did not read that yet. The time is coming that he's speaking of. A little bit of a different direction, Ivan. I like to ask this on some of the guests. Do you have any like daily rituals, habits, things of that nature that contribute to your success in the real estate business, but maybe aren't directly related to the real estate business?
Yeah, for sure. I spend more time now on self-reading self-development books or books like Howard wrote, right? Like an overall investment strategy with some historical significance versus who's got the newest real estate book out, right? My car, like most, is on wheels university. I'm constantly listening to books. I listen to a little bit of podcasts, but I also like to take deeper dives into books. For me, you know, I've got three kids, I've got a wife, and my goal is to have a business that fits into the life I want, right? Not to have a life that has to fit into the business. So I'm pretty focused on getting up early, getting a workout in, eating right so I've got more energy. And then I'm typically trying my best, although I get off the rails like everybody else. Some sort of good content or high-level thinking in early in the day before I start checking in with emails and reacting to things. I try to look at the bigger picture early in the day. Focus on what are the big goals I have to accomplish and what do I need to do today? What's the little step I can take today to get in the right direction? Raising capital for deals is a daily thing. It's like being really good at working out in the gym. You know, you don't just go in the morning on Saturdays and work out for 4 hours and expect to make a lot of progress. If that's the only day you made it in. It's doing those push-ups and those reps every day. So I'm constantly focused on working that pipeline and those relationships. That covers most of it. I'm a huge fan of little improvements every day that add up over time. I think far too often people put off making the big changes in their life because they feel like it's a big change, when instead they really just need to focus on little better habits that they can start immediately today. And that sort of momentum has a snowball effect, like you obviously know and I know, and it's fun to hopefully add that perspective to your audience.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I did know the answer when I asked. I have myself, I remember like, I don't know, God, 7-8 years now. I went on a self-improvement mission, and I was listening to Jim Rohn, and he said something like, you start with an apple. Buy an apple and plan to eat the apple every day. You know, the apple a day keeps the doctor away. And he's like, and when you do this intentionally and you are eating that apple because you're intending to find another small little thing that you can add, you'll start to have these ideas. And it's okay, I can live with that. So I got the apple. At the time, I smoking cigarettes. Eventually, I ended up at the gym. And then I'm like smoking outside the gym, and I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't fit anymore. Quit smoking that day. Quit drinking around that same time. And, you know, that same find the next small little improvement thing, I applied that first in some of my personal habits, and literally starting with the apple, then getting to goal setting, then applying these things and, you know, finding ways to build momentum in my business life and a lot of other places in my personal life too. But one thing I find interesting about your story, Ivan, and I don't know if you've taken a look at it that way before yourself or not, but, you know, 2006, 2007, I got into the business, flipping houses, start making good money, and I figure, like, yep. Midas touch. You know, everything's touching and turning to gold. I can't do any wrong, and everything was working out great, and then the music stopped, and it crashed, and but around that time and through that time, I remember like thinking for me and my path was, oh, I'm going to, you know, do multifamily like a lot of people are doing. I don't think I assessed maybe like my assets, my content tax. And when I say assets, I'm not talking about like a stock portfolio and the houses I own or don't own, but more of my own personal experience and history. And I'm curious to whether you ever consciously looked back over you know, being raised in a household with, you know, dad was an attorney and he guided you into real estate in this way and probably gave you some guidance. And then you were working with probably some big numbers and some big risk with the development stuff that you did before the market did crash. And like, how much of an impact, if you notice any, did all of that stuff have, you know, when you got to 2010 through 2014 to now 2019, where it's, you know, the numbers are $300 million in assets. I mean, have you ever taken a look at that at all?
Oh, man. I mean, yes, absolutely. Huge impact in my life. Huge. Feel very blessed, grateful to have that history behind all this. You know, first and foremost, very lucky to have the dad I have, and the mom, you know, both who taught me to march to the beat of my own drum and made me permanently unemployable. So for me, it was, you know, it was either a life of crime or start my own company. And thankful to say I've got three little, crazy spirited children myself. The single greatest gift of my adult career was getting hammered, you know, in 2008, because I had the Midas touch. I thought, you know, I was a big cowboy, big hat, no cattle cowboy, thinking that was just the way real estate was. And I was really good at it. And so that really hit the mental reset button for me. And those experiences are forever in my DNA of how now I look at risk first, right? And every deal is a no, and it has to prove itself as a hell yes first. Little things like that. You know, I had to, when I started over, I was a couple hundred grand in debt. I think I was 29 or 30. Trying to convince my girlfriend, who's my wife now at the time, that like I'm a safe bet, you know, and she's like, well, wait a second, would you marry me if I had 200 grand in debt, you know? And it was a huge slice of humble pie. And I finally had to say to myself, like, you know, I'd always wanted to own big apartments, but I had to stop looking at that and start looking at my feet and saying, how am I going to put one foot in front of the other? Right. Forget about the big deals. How am I just going to do the next deal? And so, you know, my next purchase was a couple of duplexes I bought with hard money and learned how to rehab them. And then I got a couple more, and then I got a six unit. Right. And at the same time, I'm managing other people's condos they couldn't sell, homes they couldn't sell, other investors that had rental properties. And I'm learning that the hard way. I didn't know everything I needed to know when I started that business. I just learned as I went. But I feel so lucky because I had already had about, you know, 10,000 hours of real estate, most of it how not to practice real estate, right? It was like, you know, Edison talking about knowing 9,999 ways that you could not make a light bulb. That was me. I tripped over every branch and stick and twig and rock and ditch on the trail, on the path less taken. I just made a habit of not tripping over the same one twice, not making the same mistake. And so I can tell you, I've made almost every one in the book, but I rarely make the same mistake twice. And that's the kind of momentum that over time, really builds into something fun. But there's a lot of people that want to shortcut that, and they either never get started because they have to have it all figured out first, right? Or they burn out early because it got too hard. When you realize that it's supposed to be hard, you're supposed to have some sleepless nights, you're supposed to screw up, right? I mean, I fired so many people that I had no business ever hiring along the way. I made so many mistakes early on. And then I started finding the right people, and I found people that were better than hiring at me. And I gave them the mission to hire great people. Right. But in the beginning, I was 30 pounds heavier than I am today, stopped going to the gym, you know, barely a good husband, you know, then kids start coming along. It's really easy to get, to get out of whack as you're growing this real estate business. If I had to do it all over again, I'd be doing it a much different way, because now, you know, it's just as important for me to have these other boxes checked, right? I want to make an impact on my community. You know, leave behind a legacy. There's charitable efforts that my wife and I are focused on. You know, we want to raise great kids. We want to have a great marriage. We don't want to be divorced when the kids move out. You know, there's all these other things that go along with that. The best part is real estate can be an amazing platform for doing that. And if you're not willing to go through all that and pay all that tuition and burn up all that perspiration, then it's probably better to do what you're really good at. And then, you know, partner with guys like you and me.
For sure. So Ivan, if you could go back, maybe like right in the heyday, if you would have listened back there in the mid 2000s, when you were developing, if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself back then, knowing what you know now in 2019, what would that be?
Oh man, I would have bought so much more real estate back then. I would have gone bigger, not bigger deals, but I would have bought more of those duplexes in that neighborhood. I would have bought more of those small apartment buildings. If I could go back in time, if I could tell my 18-year-old self, you know, I would say, hey, don't even go to college. Go find the guy that you want to be and work for free, even if you have to bartend at night, you know, or wait tables on the weekends. There's so much. I would say definitely don't stop going to the gym. You know, I stopped really being focused on my fitness for nearly 8 years. I'll never let that happen again. Yeah. Yeah, I made every mistake in the book. I got a lot of advice to give my 18-year-old self. tons of crown jewels. Now, if today, if you know, my wife and I were talking about this, what is so gratifying and relieves a ton of stress and fear and concern about the future, if I lost it all tomorrow, which would be very hard to do now because real estate, you can silo it, you've got asset protection. But if everything went away tomorrow, I would literally start over doing the same thing.
Absolutely. Do you by any chance have a mentor or two, even now, or somebody that you looked at that way?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Always had mentors. I've got coaches. I've got mentors. One of my favorite is a guy that owns about 15,000 units, and he's got a fully integrated management company. They're a big owner here in Indy. I buy him lunch. I'd buy him lunch once a week, but you know, usually I get to sit down with him maybe three or four times a year, and he's always got a few nuggets to share. And a guy who passed away, who's kind of one of the godfathers of multifamily around here, used to be the same thing for him. So he's paying it forward to me, and that's a lot of fun. You know, most of my mentors have never met me. Some of my favorite authors in real estate. But I'm always trying to surround myself. I've got a coach in just about every aspect of my life now, someone to hold me accountable. And a big fan of EO, Entrepreneurs Organization. So I get to surround myself with other entrepreneurs who have a operating company that's got a minimum of $1 million in revenue. And so we go through life together and help each other learn and grow. And I do a ton of that stuff because as the owner, founder, CEO of the company, you know, it's my job to focus on that big picture. Where are we going? How do we get there? How do we get great people banging down our door? There's, in my opinion, there's no way to do this without people that you can stretch up to, that you can look up to, that have been there. This nothing we're doing is new. It's all been done before. And I'm a huge fan of cloning or modeling successful human beings that have blazed that path ahead of me.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I mean, one of the reasons I do the podcast at all, Ivan, is because it allows me to have a conversation with someone like you who you don't have an hour to close the door and hop on a call. Just like your mentor, who you're lucky to meet three times a year, like time is valuable for people who are like doing a lot of stuff. It's been a blessing and a pleasure to be able to do the podcast with you and the countless guests. And I'm sure the listeners, they also enjoy that. So yeah, appreciate that. Speaking of
likewise,
authors,
fun to be here.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of authors and stuff, any book recommendations before we wrap up here?
What you want a category? Give me a category.
Okay, you want real estate,
you want self-development, you want economics.
We'll do two books. One for someone who's beginning in real estate, who you think they should take a look at. And the second one is a book recommendation for me, whose company is doing between three, and we'll probably hit 4.5 to 5 million before the end of the year, doing single family houses. So what book you might recommend to me besides the Howard Marks book we already touched on?
Ooh, beginning book in real estate. I mean, one of my favorite, like, general old school real estate books is in apartments. It'd be Dave Lindahl's Multifamily Millions and Emerging Markets. I know you want me to just give one, but I can't do that. A great overall one. Another one is The Real Estate Game by William Porvoo. That's one of my all-time classic favorites as well. And now you got to push me to a book to a guy who's already doing $4 million in revenue. I'm gonna tell you, Traction might be a great book for you. We're implementing EOS, the Entrepreneur Operating System, based on Gene Wickman's book Traction. It has been a game changer for my executive team because we got to a point where they couldn't work any harder, and they needed to work smarter, grow leaders underneath them, hold people accountable, have more clarity. It's been a great book for me, my business partner, and our four-person executive team underneath us. If we're going to do a third category, I'm a big fan of James Rickard's new book, Aftermath. I think James Rickard is an incredibly smart guy. You know, he sometimes gets lumped in with the gold bugs. But I think he's bigger than that. I think he's got really great, prescient advice on what's going on, you know, with the global economy, which ultimately now affects real estate, because real estate is global now. And there's so much capital around the world looking to be here in the United States. Love that book. Of course, I listened to all those books that I just rattled off.
I would hope not, so. I hope you're not making blind recommendations.
No. What I mean is, if I tried to read those books, I'd get through two pages
a
day. Yeah. I'm a huge Audible guy.
Agreed. Yeah, Audible is life changing. If you don't have that on your phone, you are missing the boat.
Yeah. Good luck if you don't have that.
Cool. Hey, Ivan, any way that listeners can get in touch with you, maybe a website or some contact info you'd like to share?
Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. My last name, if you can spell it right, Barratt. It looks like Barratt, Ivan Barratt, Barratt. The main site is barrattassetmanagement.com. I've also got a video series at ivanbarratteducation.com. If you'd like to talk to me, My admin's phone number, she's very good at getting me on the phone, 317-762-2625, 317-762-2625.
All right, cool. Hey, this was a great episode for me personally. I had a lot of fun. I appreciate your time. So I thank you, Ivan, for coming on the show.
Dan, I couldn't be more in the same boat as you, man. The pleasure's all mine. Love the conversation. Love your interview style. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next episode. Jochen Fletcher, founder of Silicon Valley-backed Nest Egg, joins us here on the show to discuss the evolution of property management, including free ACH rent clearance for your tenants, as well as some low-cost insurance against bad tenants that actually pays out if the tenant does not, and you have to do the eviction, and nearly automated repair request fulfillment are the ways of the future for all of us buy and hold real estate investors. You'll have to check out that episode for the details. So, 2019 has been a banner year for my house flipping company, Diamond Equity Investments. To date, it is now about the end of October, and we have closed 163 deals for a total gross profit of $3,500,443.36, or an average profit per deal of $21,475.11. And our inventory of houses either currently owned or awaiting either the buy or sell side closing, we have another 91 houses. We are truly blessed as an organization. Now, that $3.5 million gross profit gets whacked up with a number of my partners throughout the Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia regional markets where we concentrate our activity. But those numbers have been life-changing for nearly everyone on the team. And here's a fun fact that you might not know. Quite a few of my partners found me, found Diamond Equity Investments, by listening to the REI Diamond Show, just like you're doing right now. That's how we met, we began doing business, and the rest is history. I mention this because we are currently seeking a few additional partners to help round out our team. Potentially in Philadelphia, Chicago, or Atlanta, depending on who steps up first. If you are potentially interested in exploring a partnership like that with Diamond Equity Investments, and you'd like some more information, please go to www.dealswithroi.com and click on the careers link. Again, that website is www.dealswithroi.com. The ROI is like return on investment. Now, are you interested in a pre-release of that next episode, the one I mentioned with Jochen Fletcher and Nest Egg? That is before the email goes out with the announcement. When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcast apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, you'll receive advanced notification as soon as episodes are published, as opposed to Saturday when that email announcement is sent. If you prefer the email, just head over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. Accredited investors seeking double-digit returns in short-term passive investments can head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out those high-yield investment opportunities. And this concludes our episode here today. Thank you again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. I appreciate you. Dan Breslin here. Catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.